Another record was set in the COVID pandemic a few days ago, and this time it was not a record for cases or some other indication of spreading disease. On Saturday, a reported 4 million COVID vaccines were given in the United States, a one-day record. That came just a few days after Jackson County's new cases showed a one-day spike up to 73, a number that has not been repeated since. Dr. Jim Shames is the medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. He visits once a week to field questions from me and you about the pandemic and the response. Dr. Shames, welcome back.
Hi, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. So catch us up on the trends. I noticed the county's two-week average of new cases are climbing as of yesterday's release.
Well, they're kind of going up and down. I think we were about 21 a couple days ago, and then there were 31. And as you mentioned, we had that spike, that one-day spike. So we really have to see what the trend is over many weeks to know where we're going. At the moment, we feel kind of plateaued. At a higher level than we'd like, but it's not obvious to me that we're going up.
All right, so it's not high enough to put Jackson County back into extreme, 188.9 cases per 100,000 population for weeks 12 and 13 of this year.
Right.
But also not getting it back into moderate territory, I see.
Exactly, right. No, we're close. We need to definitely do all we can to bring the numbers down. Mm-hmm.
I was mentioning yesterday's release. Speaking of which, your department used to put out a daily report. Now it's just a dashboard of numbers and a weekly report. What's the thinking there?
I'm not sure. I suspect it's partly just allocation of valuable staff time, plus what we think really is going to reflect what the public needs to know. We're not trying to hide anything, but we are pretty busy.
All right. So the dashboard includes a chart, showing total cases by week in addition to the daily raw number. And the most interesting thing here on that chart is how weekly new cases stayed around 100 through most of the measuring period, through most of the pandemic until the middle of October, then shot above 150. And the numbers have stayed well above that, only coming down to the high 100s here lately, I notice.
Yeah. You know, as we look at what might be going on, we need to remember that this is to some extent a regional issue, and to some extent it reflects sort of risk categories that some counties have more than others, socioeconomic factors, geographic factors that will influence the number of people who get COVID, for example. And so when you look at Douglas and Josephine, Curry, Klamath County, you see some similar trends.
All right. So we talked briefly about that at 73 on Thursday, which was more even than Multnomah County. Portland had the same day. I imagine there are some cautions not to read too much into a single day.
No, you really can't. There's lots of things that are involved in how the state reports out its COVID cases. You've just really got to look at trends.
All right, let's take a phone call here. Michael in Wonder. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Jim Shames. Michael, you there? There we go.
I know someone who had an anaphylactic shock reaction to the flu vaccine. And this person is extremely hesitant to get the COVID vaccine. And what would you say to that person?
That is a good question. Thanks for that, Michael. So, Dr. Shames, if you got a reaction to the flu vaccine, what's right. the procedure right. for COVID?
Yeah, that's a really good question. First of all, the thing to know is that anaphylaxis to the COVID vaccine is quite rare. We're talking about something in the range of 5 per million. I don't believe anyone has died of an anaphylactic reaction to the COVID vaccine. Nevertheless, if you have had an anaphylactic reaction in the past, it's a good idea to let the vaccinators know and to be sure that you stick around for at least a half an hour after the vaccine. So you want to have medical personnel alerted to your past history. They'll be prepared for you. For example, at all of the vaccine sites I'm aware of have epinephrine. They've got antihistamines. They have ready access to emergency care. So the only contraindication that I'm aware of to getting vaccinated is a true anaphylactic reaction to one of the components in the vaccine, and that's pretty rare. So I would say a serious reaction to a flu shot would not be an absolute contraindication to getting the COVID vaccine, any of the COVID vaccines, but I'd be sure that the medical staff is aware prior to getting injected.
So what are the ranges of questions that are asked of people as they get a vaccine in terms of their allergies?
Well, that's one question. You know, have you had an anaphylactic type reaction in the past? And then usually, for example, I can relate to what I saw happening at the drive-through at the expo. Mm-hmm. There'd be a physician on site who would then come over and question them further, and presumably sort of alert the vaccinating staff, make sure the person knew they had to stick around for a half an hour, that sort of thing.
Any food allergies? I think we talked about this a little bit before, but there was some question about other kinds of allergies that might come into play.
Sure. I think any, you know, some people are just more allergenic than others, and that, you know, puts them at risk perhaps for, you know, having some kind of a systemic reaction to a number of things, perhaps including the COVID vaccine. So I think it's always good to be safe, but, you know, COVID's a serious illness, and you don't want to just arbitrarily keep people from getting the protection of the vaccine unless it's absolutely clear. And in most cases, it's not.
Dr. Jim Shames, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange from Jackson County Health and Human Services, Jackson County's medical director, fielding our questions about COVID-19 and the response. You can join in at 800-838-3760 by phone or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. I have a question here. Before I get to the question, though, I want to come back to, you mentioned the drive-through event. Those are not happening anymore. Is it just those were the idea for like a fast boost to the system, and then now you got greater distribution to different places to get the vaccines? Is that why they're no longer going on?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to look at it, Jeffrey. We certainly got our numbers up quickly. We were able to get those important risk groups covered, you know, within just a couple of days. But first of all, there just are only so many resources in the state. You know, we had National Guard, and we had hundreds, maybe 400 or 500 volunteers, and those people are now being put to work on daily, regular, high volume, high pass through vaccination events in the county, ongoing. So we would not easily be able to pull together the resources to do another clinic like that.
All right, so that really was a major production. I had forgotten about the National Guard and some of the other involvements there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's see, the question here from Julie in Medford, two questions. One, I'd like to know how the current Pfizer, Moderna, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are faring against the COVID variants. And two, I'd also like to know if you can spread COVID-19 after getting the vaccine. Can you still spread it after getting one dose, two doses? Those questions from Julie in Medford. If you need a refresher, I can give it to you.
No, I think you got it. So as far as protection against the variants, we are concerned because the variants do seem to spread more quickly and in some cases have more serious disease. And the vaccines theoretically may not be as completely effective against variants. What does seem to be true is that the ability for the vaccine to prevent serious illness, hospitalization, and death remains strong even with variants. That's not to say that a variant may not develop that could, in fact, be able to bypass the effectiveness of a vaccine, but we don't seem to have that yet. And I mention that because the most important way to diminish the effect of the variants is to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible to prevent the spread of COVID, because the variants only develop and strengthen when there is rapid spread of the disease. The second question was,
If you can spread after getting the vaccine, one dose, two doses.
Right. So sterilizing immunity, the ability to prevent the virus from replicating in your body, is variable and not always absolutely necessary. for a vaccine to be effective. And it wasn't what was tested. What was tested when the vaccines were rolled out was, will this vaccine prevent you from getting sick? And if so, if you do get sick, you know, how sick do you get? And what we found out was the vaccines are very effective at preventing you from getting sick and amazingly effective in helping you not get seriously ill or hospitalized for death or have a fatal outcome. But as far as the question of can you spread it, having been vaccinated, that's still open for debate. So we're not sure. But at the moment, it appears that in the majority of cases, you don't get the virus, you don't grow the virus, and you don't spread it to others.
Yeah, and I can imagine, I'm going to ask you as a health professional, what it's like to try to keep up with things like new information, new studies going on about spreadability during vaccination periods, because it seems like there's probably an avalanche of stuff coming out to medical professionals, in addition to things like for yesterday we got from the CDC, which I'll get to in a moment.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, in the old days we were used to, you know, scientific information being completely vetted. You know, it goes to a committee of people. They decide, you know, that it's valid before it gets printed in a journal. It gets discussed in the journal. And now, you know, just all information just gets poured out there. And you know, you really have to look to others to see what's valid. And even when some people think it's valid, you know, this accelerated process are going to let some bits of information go through that just aren't. Just turn out not to be true. I try and dedicate a certain amount of time every day to keeping up with what's happening, but it's a deluge, and I certainly can miss stuff.
Yeah, well, I was just running through the stuff yesterday, getting ready for this session, and noticing how much stuff the CDC put out just yesterday, which, again, more in a moment. Let's take a call here. Pete in Jacksonville, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Jim Shames.
Good morning.
Hi.
So, I'm curious about the statistics. If, in fact, the folks who previously have gotten sick were the low-hanging fruit, and we're still getting large amounts of people who were not in the most susceptible group, can we interpret the numbers that are being released, you know, daily numbers or percentages, as being statistically valid, or does it fall into one of those, if I can quote Mark Twain, there are lies, damn lies, and statistics? How are we to interpret the fact that we have a continuing large amount of people who are sick enough to fall into the reportable category going on even now?
And I appreciate that, Pete. But is sick enough to be reportable? Or is it just that they test positive, Jim Shames?
Oh, they test positive, mm-hmm. I hear what you're saying. What's going on here is that the demographics of who's turning up positive on tests has shifted since the beginning of the pandemic, and increasingly we're coming across young folks, people of working age. People who have to get out there and, you know, tend the cash register and you know, plant our crops, those folks are getting positive. And it's part of the reason why, even though we have a fairly high level of positivity, our hospitalizations and death rate are much lower than they were at a comparable level before. So different people are getting infected. Fewer people are getting tested. So, you know, back to your point about can we hang our hat on this data, you know, we don't have quite as many tests being done, so we're a little unclear how extensive the positivity is. We have variants, which we know are by and large more infectious, so more people get infected every time one person gets infected. I'm not personally finding the data very confusing. It seems to make some sense to me.
As far as the variants, a point I want to bring in about that is that the variants are are harder on people individually or that they spread faster from person to person or both?
Well, I think it's fairly settled that they seem to spread faster from person to person. And obviously, if you get more people infected, you're going to end up with more people that get sick and more people, you know, go to the hospital and more people die. So there's sort of a bit of increased mortality, and there is some debate about whether some of the variants, like the P1 variant or the one from Brazil, whether they in fact increase the mortality as well. You know, just not just by volume, but because they're more serious diseases.
Mm-hmm. We have the CDC yesterday saying about surfaces that you can potentially get infected, but the risk is low. And so the CDC is essentially backing off from disinfection and saying soap and detergent cleaning should be enough.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that there's always been a suspicion that that's probably been true. This is a fairly fastidious virus in the sense that it doesn't take a lot to kill it. And except for, shiny hard surfaces, it doesn't remain alive on surfaces very long. So I do think there's been a little bit of misdirected attention towards cleaning, when in fact the real critical factors are masking and distancing, and watching, the airflow in a room. Those are the critical factors. But cleaning is helpful, but after a certain amount of time, it's just very unlikely that the virus is sitting on a surface and going to infect you.
Okay, about a minute left, time enough to get a quick call in from Oliver in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Exchange.
Hey, thanks a lot. I had COVID, and my wife and son were all tested positive, but my little 4-year-old girl just will not test positive. She's negative every single time we tested her for a few weeks now, and we cannot get an antibody test so that we can go visit some family. I'm just wondering if there's an antibody test out there that we don't know about. I think we found one. It's like $70, but they're not getting back to us.
Wow.
Just wondering if there's something out there that can help.
All right. Thanks for the question, Oliver. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Kids will often have very transient, levels of infectivity. So you may have just missed your window with her. She may have had it and you'd never know it. I don't think the antibody tests are terribly reliable, both because they're all over the map in terms of what they're testing, and I'm afraid I can't help you there.
It sounds like he's been down a bit of a train already, so you're going to have to keep looking for that. Oliver, sorry about that. Dr. Jim Shames from Jackson County Health and Human Services, the County Medical Director, thank you for joining us once again on the Jefferson Exchange.
You bet. Thanks for having me.